You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, online learning has been one way to ensure a safe college education this fall. But what about those programs that require a little more hands-on learning? Wisconsin Technical College instructors tell us how they're teaching future mechanics and builders. First, when we talk about food deserts, it's usually in the context of urban areas where there's not maybe a local grocery store and residents don't have access to fresh and healthy food. But rural residents can also face food insecurity, and the problem can be made even trickier because of fewer transportation options and social services. One Wisconsin group is trying to address that need with what they call hyper-local agriculture that can bring fresh produce not only to a neighborhood, but to a childcare facility, a community center, maybe even somebody's home. Alex Tank is co-founder of Fork Farms and the inventor of its farming technology and methods. He's a former opera singer with 10 years of leadership experience in the social service sector. In 2018, he was a Fox Cities Future 15 winner and featured as Fox Cities Magazine's Big Idea. Alex, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Start us off with the idea of food insecurity in the middle of rural Wisconsin. It seems like a contradiction. What's happening?
Well, that's a great point. I mean, the rural Wisconsin is where we grow so much of the nation's food, and there's so much incredible work there to feed the world. But ironically, it's where a significant amount of food insecurity happens in the state. And the reason is it's because poverty is on a significant increase in rural communities. And there's been a real conglomeration of grocery stores. And so you're seeing a lot fewer smaller markets in rural areas in favor of larger grocery chains in more urban areas. And so it's effectively made gas stations and dollar stores the de facto food sources for these rural areas.
And it's a little strange, as I understand it, you're importing a solution to the problem in a way from Brooklyn, not Brooklyn, Wisconsin, but the one in New York. Talk about what you learned there that you've kind of ported over into rural Wisconsin.
Well, sure. Well, I'm actually originally from Appleton, Wisconsin. I moved out to New York back in the day for the opera career, which you mentioned briefly. But when I was there, I really got passionate about poverty. You see poverty in New York City in a way that you just don't in Wisconsin sometimes. We do a really good job taking care of our communities, and poverty is more hidden here than in the city. And so for me, it made a huge impact. And when I saw people growing food on rooftops and inside of food pantries, I got really inspired as this being a potential mechanism to feed people in an innovative way that will also connect them to their food supply. And I really believe that when people grow their own food, you're significantly more likely to eat healthier and to feel better. And not because your doctor told you you have to, but really because you truly want to.
That takes us to this idea of micro agriculture. What is that?
Well, so our theory is that if we can figure out how to grow food, really good fresh food, affordably, and that's the key, is you have to be able to grow it in a way where you're competing with commodity prices, but where it doesn't have to ship 1,500 miles like it does now, and it can have the longest shelf life possible. Most people don't know that in transit, fresh food can lose 40-50% of its nutritional content. And so for us, we're trying to figure out how do you take a technological solution that anybody can use that's really simple and affordable and place that in places where people work, live, and play and allow them to become the farmers. So anybody could become a farmer and feed their community in the middle of winter even. Which for Wisconsin is important because we need to eat these fresh products year-round.
We're talking to Alex Tank, co-founder of Fork Farms and inventor of its farming technology and methods, talking about micro-agriculture and a pilot project he's had going on in Rusk County. Now take us to Rusk County in the northwestern part of the state. What's happening? What's on the ground there now?
Well, Rusk County itself is a food desert. The entire county is a food desert. It's got some of the highest poverty rates in the state. And Marshfield Clinic really cares deeply about the communities that they serve. And we got connected to them a while back, and they really saw what we were doing as being a potential public health solution. This type of technology, you know, and the amount of food that we can grow in such a small amount of space really, I think, tickled their interest in, can we implement this in a way where we can really start to transform the food landscape. And if we get enough people involved in the process, could that long-term affect food culture? Could it really help people redefine their own eating habits? And could it create some long-term healthy habits that will just benefit everybody? It benefits the participant in the program. It benefits the healthcare system and the community at large.
You mentioned growing all year long. Does that mean people in Rusk County, people or institutions have, in effect, some hydroponic setup?
Yeah. So we have a small unit. It's about the size of a refrigerator. It's 3 feet by 3 feet is the footprint. It's about 6 feet tall, but it grows on average 20 to 30 pounds of food every 3 or 4 weeks. Wow. So, and what we grow are the most highly perishables, right? We grow a lot of potatoes in our state, a lot of other root crops. For indoor farming, it doesn't make as much sense, and you can't make as deep of a nutritional impact with those products. And so we've really focused on salad greens, herbs, strawberries, things like that, that generally don't have access to in a food desert at all. And if you do, it has a really, really short shelf life. It's right at the end of its life cycle. So, we call it a farm in a box. We ship this system. We train people how to use it. We wrap a bunch of education around it, you know, for schools, lesson plans, for, you know, assisted living facilities, meaningful activities for community centers, volunteer programs, anything that we can do to help with the engagement process, we found is really important to the success of this type of program.
I hear hydroponic and I think complicated. Is this something that somebody without a lot of agricultural background can really learn with a little training and be successful?
You know, I'd argue it's actually easier, I think. I mean, we can provide standard recipes for things where if you just follow the instructions, that you'll almost be guaranteed a successful harvest. So an example of that is we ship with these units a type of lettuce that's called Green Star. It's really dark green, beautiful broadleaf lettuce. And I tell you, if you have a black thumb, which we get a lot of people who talk about that, you can grow this stuff. I guarantee it. I mean, it's as simple as you check the nutrient level of the water. If it's a little low, you add a tablespoon of this, a tablespoon of that. You check the pH by adding little drops into a little container to see what color it changes, just like you would with a swimming pool. Add a little bit to get that right. And then you can leave it for a week if you want to. I mean, it really takes about 5 to 15 minutes a week to operate a program like this. And the fun part is the harvest. That also takes the most time. It takes about an hour to process 20, 30 pounds of salad greens, right? I mean, most people, when you buy in a grocery store, you're buying it 4 ounces at a time. So you can imagine the amount that you're getting out of this.
Talk about, you know, the feelings side of things, where somebody who's maybe never grown anything before comes out and they've just harvested their first, as you say, 15, 20 pounds of healthy food. Talk about the attitude change you might see from people.
Well, you know, we get a lot of reports, but I can speak from personal experience on this, actually. I mean, one summer in Brooklyn, I decided to volunteer for a guy growing food on a rooftop, and they were feeding the food pantry that was right downstairs in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And so on its own, a really cool ecosystem that they created in that community. But I was allowed to bring some of this food home, and it was really the first time that I had done this. I was pretty fresh out of college, and at the time, eating in a way that I think most of us eat, making food decisions based on price and convenience. I needed it to fill me up, and I needed it to be cheap and easy. And when you're in poverty, that's even more important, right? Because you have so many other stress factors in your life. So when I ate this food that I grew, something just really clicked with me. I mean, I gained this immediate appreciation. You know, it's like your kids are for some reason cuter than the other kids, or your house is more home to you than anywhere else on the planet. And I think the reason that we get emotionally attached with these things is just because we put our love and our blood and our sweat and our tears into things, and you can't help but become connected to that thing. And I believe personally that that sort of interconnection is really what's at the root of all real, true, meaningful social change. Because if you can get people to care about these things in a real, authentic way, that will lead to sustainable change, long-term change. And I think that we are seeing now time and time and time again with communities all over the place, small installations, big installations, that that is the case, that it works.
As we wrap up, Alex, you've got this pilot program in Rusk County. Are you looking to expand elsewhere in Wisconsin and beyond?
Yeah, absolutely. We've got great partnerships with Feeding America, food banks, and a number of healthcare organizations across the country. We really believe that food is medicine, and that this type of program can, you know, really bring it on site to anybody. And as an organization, we're in about 27 states in Canada, but we think that the sky's the limit. We think that this is a way that with others, we could potentially be a piece of a solution to what we think is a really big food problem.
Alex, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Alex Tank is co-founder of Fork Farms. He joined us to talk about the group's pilot project in Rusk County to address food insecurity in that community with micro-agriculture projects. Coming up, we'll hear from two Wisconsin technical school instructors about what they're doing to teach their hands-on lessons to students in the midst of the pandemic. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's our look at the week's top political news, including the incredible shrinking party conventions, with both candidates say they're not going to deliver acceptance speeches in person. First, while many colleges are pivoting to virtual learning options, some classes are harder to teach through a computer. In-person hands-on learning is important in many skilled trades like auto mechanics, truck driving, construction, and more. But how are colleges planning to continue those kind of classes during a pandemic? We have two instructors joining us right now. Sandy Thistle is the co-program director for Madison College's Construction and Remodeling Program. Sandy, welcome back.
Hello. Glad to
and
be
Travis,
here.
And Travis Gay is an automotive technician instructor at Chippewa Valley Technical College in Eau Claire. Travis, thanks for joining us today. Oop, do we have Travis? Not there. Okay, well, we'll start with you then, Sandy. Can you talk about what your classes, your hands-on classes, are going to look like this fall?
That's a good question. Some of the fundamental things are clear, such as the safety protocols and that are in place, and we will continue. In order to keep everyone safe, number one priority is providing a quality learning experience and keeping people safe. It's a little bit of a tricky balance because fundamentally there is no way that we have figured out with today's affordable technologies how to provide the hands-on part of the training without in-person classes. Go ahead.
And Travis Gay, I think we have you now. Travis, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Well, can you talk, Travis, about the kind of precautions you're taking there at Chippewa Valley Technical College, you know, to do the hands-on stuff you need to do, but keep people safe?
Well, we're definitely taking advantage of our space in the shop. Instead of having the students in the classroom, we're going to kind of rearrange the shop and have them spaced out in there. Even after that, when they're working on the cars, being mindful of keeping their distance, wearing masks. And then we're going to implement basically a you touch it, you clean it policy. So similar to the gym, where when you're done using the hoist controls, you wipe the where you touched off and really just kind of practice those things, keep our distances, and really monitor who's coming in and out of the classroom or the shop. When they come on campus, they'll be questioned and temperatures taken to make sure there's no issues first off.
And Sandy, can you talk a little bit, are you doing similar kinds of precautions to what Travis was talking about there in your construction and remodeling classes?
Yes. So we are in a fortunate position in which we went online in spring whenever this really started to become a serious concern, and we needed to finish up the year with hands-on. So this summer, over the entire month of June, we practiced those protocols for in-person. So we're putting all of the lecture and theory online and only focusing on the hands-on while the students are here, and same thing, protocols, they fill out a safety screener, they must have a cloth face covering, physical distancing, they come in, they answer the questions, they wash their hands, and they stay in the space with space between them. They know that if they leave the lab, they will not be allowed to return until the next day. And, you know, there's a lot that we can do right in our space. The tricky part comes when they leave the space. So we have to assume that every single student is contagious, because there are going to be students who are contagious and they have no symptoms.
Now, I know COVID has affected jobs in a lot of workplaces. Travis, I know, and I know a lot of technical college programs are in touch with people actually working in the field. Do you know, Travis, how garages, auto shops, mechanics in your area have been affected by the pandemic?
Yeah, I actually stop into a few shops and see how everybody's doing. And I'd say the first couple weeks of the pandemic in March, you know, when everybody stopped driving, it slowed down a little bit, but then it did kind of pick up, and I would say it's mostly been back to normal. And I'm talking about, you know, customer flow. It's been back to normal. The shops, they were, you know, being mindful of disinfecting vehicles, and, you know, keeping things clean and wearing masks, when they were working on the vehicles. And, you know, it presents a challenge. You know, people may be a little hesitant to bring it in, but, they're doing their best to keep the customers' vehicles running and keep everybody safe, you know, including the customers and the employees there safe, so that they can continue to do their jobs.
And Sandy, what about in your specialty area? How has this affected people in construction and remodeling right now?
Well, we're talking about an incredible breadth of situations, from residential in someone's home to commercial work in a large space where only people who are in construction are there. And I think that there's a lot of inconsistency from company to company and the different types of construction. So I think there is no blanket protocol that's being followed by everyone in the industry.
We're talking to Sandy Thistle from Madison College and Travis Gay from Chippewa Valley Technical College, looking at how their hands-on programs are dealing with the pandemic, trying to make sure people can get the hands-on instruction they need while staying safe along the way. Travis, what are you seeing in terms of enrollment? I know with some kinds of college programs, it's been hit or miss in some schools. What are you seeing with your program?
I would say it's down a little bit. We've had a lot of questions from parents and students on how it's going to look. And, you know, the college has been working hard to get those policies, and we're starting classes on Monday for fundamentals, and we're getting those questions answered, and we're doing our best to continue to provide the hands-on. With the social distancing being a part of a challenge with space, you know, of any of the years to have a few less students, not bad. And I can't blame a student if they're unsure of if they want to come, because they do want to do a hands-on program. That, you know, it's cars, you got to fix them, you got to work with the tools. So looking at that, if there was a question if it's going to go online, you know, we got to be honest, and these guys are going to, and gals are going to, work best hands-on. And if they don't, you know, there's some hesitation there, but we're committed to the providing the hands-on. And as long as everybody does their part, like Sandy was mentioning, you know, inside of the classroom is one thing, but outside, having a conversation with the students about doing that, we should be able to keep everybody face-to-face in some degree through the semester.
And Sandy, what are you seeing for enrollment?
Well, interestingly enough, I think that our program is close to full. However, we've reduced the number of students that we'll take, partly because one of the approaches is to keep different cohorts of students separate from the other cohorts, and having an assigned teacher with that cohort for all of their classes. So we've really changed how we deliver. And then the other interesting thing is, I believe it was the Washington Post had an article about parents considering sending kids to community college rather than a four-year college right now at this time, in order to save money and open up possibilities. So I think that there is a chance that our enrollment demand will increase.
And in our last couple of minutes, I want to ask hopefully each of you, Travis, I've heard reports sometimes that current generations aren't necessarily thinking of trades like these as part of their career options. Do you want to make a quick pitch for people to make sure they're at least considering those?
Well, I think a lot of people, when they think of fixing cars, think of the guys under the hoods getting dirty. And the technology has changed so much in these vehicles. A lot of the repairs we're doing is going to be reflashing the computer. You know, there's a computer for every subsystem on a vehicle, upwards to 30, 40 of them now. And I would say the majority of the time we spend on vehicles or repairing something is locating service information, troubleshooting, figuring out how a wiring diagram runs, figuring out and where to test it, and then make that part replacement. So it's much more to fixing vehicles than getting dirty. It's a lot of computer and tech like that. Not to get anybody wrong, we still need the guys that love to dig in and get their hands dirty and do the brakes and engines. There's plenty of us, or there's plenty of things out there in the industry to keep everybody occupied with something that interests them.
And Sandy, do you want to take just our last minute or so to make the case for people to consider your construction and remodeling program?
Yes, we're very homogeneous group of people, a lot of older white men. There's a high demand for new blood in this arena. The pay is good. There's lots of opportunity. And for me, it's all about the occupational satisfaction. I love this work. I went to the UW. I could have some other job, but the kind of work I do is the right fit for me. And you add to that the high pay and the opportunity and demand, and it's a no-brainer for a lot of people. They just don't know.
Sandy, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Very happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
And Travis, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Sandy Thistle, co-program director for Madison College's Construction and Remodeling Program, and Travis Gay, an automotive technician instructor at Chippewa Valley Technical College in Eau Claire. They joined us to talk about how technical colleges and hands-on programs are adjusting the way they work for the fall. Coming up after the news, how are negotiations going for the next big coronavirus relief package in Congress, and how involved is the president? We'll get the latest from a White House correspondent. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, changes at the U.S. Postal Service are causing mail delays in some parts of the country. We'll find out how the new Postmaster General is trying to cut costs and what it can mean for absentee voting in the presidential election. First, it's our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. News broke today connecting Washington to Milwaukee. Announcements that neither former Vice President Joe Biden nor any other convention speaker will physically travel to Wisconsin for the Democratic National Convention. And President Trump is apparently not going to deliver his acceptance speech in person in Charlotte or Jacksonville. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What thoughts do you have on the party's conventions? Are you glad they're dialing them back, not making them big to-dos in the various cities, including the Democrats in Milwaukee? Do you pay attention to these big presidential nominating conventions when they happen? Have you been to one or more than one over time? What is it like? Is it a tradition that is worth keeping up or a waste of time? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Francesca Chambers is White House correspondent for McClatchy. Francesca, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the conventions and with the Democrats. We'd already seen a delay. We've been watching this closely here in Wisconsin, of course, with it being in Milwaukee. Now it's looking like even the main figures won't be there in person. What do we know about what will and won't happen in Milwaukee?
Well, definitely Vice President Joe Biden, the presumptive Democratic nominee, will not be there in Milwaukee now. And it does seem tied that he and President Trump made these announcements on the same day, because it was after President Trump said that he no longer had plans to go to a battleground state to give his speech and was likely to give his from the White House that we saw Democrats pull back and say that Joe Biden would no longer travel to Wisconsin. It kind of gave him an out, so to speak, to not have to go there if President Trump was planning to do his from the White House.
Let's look at the politics of this here in Wisconsin. I know the Hillary Clinton campaign was criticized for not bringing her into Wisconsin at key points in the presidential race. You know, people argue whether or not it would have made a difference one way or the other. But is that a concern if Joe Biden isn't front and center in this really tightly contested swing state?
But President Trump has also not been particularly front and center in the state of Wisconsin. And he has said that he would like to be in states doing rallies, but that he can't be given the restrictions in some states on gatherings. And of course, it leaves a big footprint. He has noted, and the White House has noted, when he has to come in with security and Secret Service. And of course, when the president did try to have one large rally in Tulsa, then he had members of his advance team test positive for the coronavirus at that time. So there are certainly concerns for both political candidates about going and having large footprints or gatherings at this point in the crisis.
Let's turn over to the Republican side here and President Trump. I want to give a listen to the president suggesting he's not going to go to Charlotte. He's not going to go to Florida, to Jacksonville, saying maybe the White House. Here he is speaking this morning on Fox and Friends.
So it looks like live from the White House. It's would you say you're locked in on that?
No.
Okay.
If for some reason somebody had difficulty with it, I could go someplace else. The easiest, least expensive, and I think very beautiful would be live from the White House.
You're home there, and the bills are all paid for.
So this idea, again, not locked in by any means, Francesca, of the president delivering his acceptance speech from the White House grounds itself. What's been the response to that idea?
Well, there's some concern about the idea of the president doing a blatantly political event from the grounds of the White House, even when he goes to other states and it's official events and he might talk about Joe Biden and he might talk about the election. There's still official events in which he's there for some policy that's related to the area he's in. But to have an event at the White House for the Republicans in this way is definitely turning some heads.
One of the trademarks, of course, of the president's previous campaign was his big rallies, was these big in-person events. He certainly seemed to like them. His supporters did. Got a lot of media coverage. How much is this cramping his style, a candidate who especially likes these big gatherings?
Well, now the president is doing tele-rallies, as they're calling them. So the campaign is calling into landline phones, including in Wisconsin, where he's had two of these so far, including one this week on Monday. And people can pick up the phone and hear if they want to stay on to hear from the president of the United States. Now, these are lasting about half an hour. The campaign hasn't disclosed exactly who they're calling in the state, but the messages that you're hearing from the president are very predictable for him, touching on the issues that you would often hear him hit at a rally in Wisconsin. He's been focusing on the farmers. He's been focusing on the trade deals. Again, talking for about a half hour at these. And they also live stream on Facebook, by the way, for anyone who wants to go back and see what the president's been telling his voters. But that's one way that he's been working around the fact that he can't come to states and have these rallies.
We're talking to Francesca Chambers, White House correspondent for McClatchy, talking about some of the top stories in national politics. Let's bring on a caller on the convention issue at 800-642-1234. Tim is with us in Jackson County. Tim, hi.
How are you?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Tim?
Well, I'm wondering now that Joe Biden, is going to give his acceptance speech from Delaware, is he going to do that live or will it be taped? Because I'm concerned that the guy can't even follow a teleprompter.
Tim, thanks a lot for the call. Do we know if this is planned to be a live speech or a taped one, Francesca?
They haven't specifically addressed that yet. We just know it will be from the state of Delaware. We don't know where in the state of Delaware. They have said that some of the programming for the 2 hours each night that they have planned will be live, and it will be a mixture, however, of live and taped addresses.
Thanks for that call, Tim. And that raises a question on both sides of things here, Francesca. We've got two candidates who, frankly, when they talk live, may say stuff that has their campaign managers, you know, closing their eyes and grimacing. It could be kind of weird this time around.
This is one of the issues that has really emerged in this campaign that you really just hit on, of President Donald Trump's campaign attacking former Vice President Joe Biden along these lines. However, as you noted, President Trump has said a few things at his press conferences that he's had to either roll back or his campaign has really had to sidestep, particularly right before he stopped having those coronavirus briefings at the White House that were going on for 2 hours and offering many opportunities for that to happen, much more so now when they're more controlled and he's only taking a couple questions from reporters each time.
We heard from Gary on email saying Milwaukee and its businesses seems like they're getting a raw deal. Gary says both spent a lot of money and effort trying to win the choice for the venue. It hasn't turned out so well. Gary writes, I understand the reasons, but it seems like some of the Dems need to find a way to reimburse Milwaukee for some of its losses. And I've seen some local politicos, actually on both sides of the political spectrum, Francesca, saying, hey, you better announce Milwaukee 2024 real quick. Do you feel like the Democrats will try to, I guess, I don't know, make up for it in some way in Wisconsin?
That's an interesting question, and I don't think they've gotten that far yet. But in terms of spending money, there's still certainly the Biden campaign and other Democratic actors are still spending money on television advertisements in the state, even though the convention won't be taking place in the same way that it is now. But I would imagine that you'll hear more calls like the one that you just referenced, and I'll be curious to hear what they have to say about it.
Now, you have been following, Francesca, how campaigns are adapting here. You mentioned the tele-moves, the tele-rallies the president has had. And you also are following, I know, changes, shakeups in the president's campaign leadership. What have we seen over the last, what is it, month or so now?
So he got a new campaign manager, Bill Stepien, and one of the first things that Bill Stepien has done is he's changed the advertising strategy. I just mentioned the Democrats have ads in Wisconsin currently, but President Donald Trump does not. He's up in four states now, and they are Florida, North Carolina. He is in Georgia and Arizona. And so that appears to be one way that Bill Stepien has really shifted the strategy. Now, that focuses on states with mail-in voting where they expect people to early vote. So the campaign could still shift its strategy back to Wisconsin and other states, but that's not currently the states that they're focused on.
Sometimes people look at a shakeup like this late in the game at a presidential campaign and say, ooh, looks like they're in trouble. They're shaking up the top people. On the other hand, the Trump campaign did something very similar 4 years ago, right?
That's right. And several people who were close to the Trump campaign exactly compared it to what happened in 2016 and said, look how that turned out for him. He won afterwards. And Bill Stepien has more time than Kellyanne Conway did when that happened in 2016.
Let's bring on another caller at 800-642-1234. AJ is with us in Green Bay. AJ, hello.
Hey there. Just a quick pushback from Tim. Can't remember where Tim was calling from, accusing Biden of not being able to read off a teleprompter. Well, that's kind of rich coming from Trump, who's been too busy ingesting bleach and household cleaners trying to cure the coronavirus.
AJ, thanks for the call. This is another case, Francesca. We're going to hear a lot of this kind of talk, I think, for both sides about the capabilities of the opposing candidate.
And even within the people close in the circle to President Donald Trump, in the story that you referenced that I wrote about the campaign shakeup, there were several people who were willing to recognize that he is down to Joe Biden, that he was, at least before Bill Stepien came in, losing to Joe Biden. And one person told me that the problem was the candidate, not the campaign. And they referenced that moment at the podium where the president talked about disinfectant and the coronavirus. And so there's very, you know, few people sometimes are willing to talk on the record about it, but there are people who are close to the president who feel that he needs to do some shaking up as well.
We're talking to Francesca Chambers, White House correspondent for McClatchy. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, a change of topic, the ongoing saga of congressional efforts to negotiate, along with the White House, a new economic relief package. Big, small meaning maybe $1 trillion, still pretty big, or what? We don't know yet. What do you want to see happen? Do you want to see unemployment benefit enhancements extended, or I guess reinstated? Should they continue at that $600 a week level for people who are unemployed? What else do you think money should be spent on, if anything? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with White House correspondent Francesca Chambers of McClatchy. It's the week in Washington. We're talking about some top national political stories. Let's take another call on conventions and speeches and related themes. Randy is with us in Madison. Randy, hi.
Good afternoon. I've been very bothered that the president has, I don't know all the protocols here, but the president has been using official White House speeches as rallies. And that tells me like the Mount Rushmore thing. That was completely a rally. And that means that we as taxpayers are paying for that. Is there any way of enforcing the difference?
Randy, thanks a lot for the call. Francesca, I know people are accused sometimes of blurring lines between this is a, you know, presidential announcement versus this is a campaign kind of thing. Is there concern that President Trump, as Randy says, has just plain crossed a line here?
And every time, as you noted, when there's an incumbent running, and President Barack Obama was accused of this as well, they're accused of using the White House resources for campaign events. And it is worth noting that when the president was just doing rallies, the campaign has to reimburse the White House or pay for Air Force One for all the people who were on it. And certainly when he's doing official events, it doesn't come down the same way. And that is why the president has really focused on the strategy currently of going to states and having official events where he is in battleground states, but he's there to talk about something besides the election so that they can say that it's an official White House event and not run afoul of any laws.
Thanks a lot for that call. Let's move to the big congressional story, and it's a White House story, too, with the possible economic recovery package, another round stalled negotiations lately. I want to give a listen to Majority Leader Mitch McConnell in the Senate, pressed yesterday at a Republican press conference about his party's position. A reporter mentioned Nancy Pelosi's comment to House Speaker about the $600 employment benefit enhancement being a red line for Democrats. And McConnell was asked if he'd support that provision if the White House backed it up. Here's a listen.
We know this is going to be a negotiated settlement. I just said it's not going to produce a kumbaya moment like we had in March or April where everybody voted aye. But the American people, in the end, need help. And wherever this thing settles between the President of the United States and his team that have to sign it into law and the Democrat, not insignificant minority in the Senate and majority in the House, is something I'm prepared to support, even if I have some problems with certain parts of it.
Okay, even easier said than done, even with all those qualifiers, Francesca. What are you watching for in this constantly moving negotiation story?
At this point, it's whether Democrats or Republicans can agree on anything at all for a big stimulus package. They're very far apart on the unemployment insurance, the extra benefit that the federal government was providing on top of what states provide already. Republicans do not want to reinstate it at the $600 rate that it had been at before. And they most recently offered $400, but Democrats are really stuck on the $600 that it was. So whether or not they can bridge that divide will be a key question. The senators are supposed to leave this Friday for recess. At this point, what we're hearing is that that's probably not going to happen, especially not if they don't get this deal. I asked President Trump last night at a news conference whether or not he could take unilateral action by executive order or some other executive action to reinstate that benefit if there isn't a deal. And he suggested that he could, although he didn't go into additional detail of what that action would look like.
Now, we have on the House side of things, Democrats passed a while back another relief package, $3.4 trillion. It includes the unemployment benefits. But what's going on within the Republican caucus on the Senate side? What are the divisions there?
So they do not want to spend that much, and some conservatives don't even want to spend the $1 trillion that Republicans are putting forward. Conservatives inside Congress, outside Congress, feel that deficit spending and the debt has gone up too much already, and that they shouldn't be spending that much at this point. And so to get a deal on a package, Republicans who want this deal are going to either have to find a way to work with conservatives in their own party or make a deal with Democrats. And neither of those two things are happening right now.
And what's the White House role in negotiations in all of this?
So White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows is helping to negotiate a deal alongside Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. But another thing I brought up at the White House yesterday during the White House press briefing with the White House press secretary was that President Trump himself doesn't seem to be too personally engaged. We don't know of him making any calls to senators on this issue. He is not personally negotiating with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi or Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. So whether or not the president decides to personally get involved in this is also something that I'll be watching.
Talking to White House correspondent Francesca Chambers from McClatchy, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Francesca, you, I think, have written about this. If you're a senator up for re-election, as a third of the Senate is this year, this argument might look different than if you don't have to run for re-election for another 2 or 4 years. How does that factor in?
Particularly for the 23 Republicans who are up for re-election this year, they're defending a hefty number of seats. And so those are the Republican senators that you primarily see that are working to get a deal on this, whereas the conservatives, as you referenced, who aren't on the ballot this year, don't have to be as concerned about facing their constituents during the August recess and coming back empty-handed.
Speaking of Senate races, I know one you feel connected to a little bit in your home state of Kansas. This one got a lot of national attention, the Republican primary for this Senate seat. Share the story with us if people haven't been following that one closely.
So Kris Kobach is someone who has been in the past close to President Trump, but he is someone that establishment Republicans did not want to win the Republican primary for that Senate seat in Kansas. And the reason being that he's a lightning rod for controversy in the state. And there was polling that showed that the Senate seat could go to Democrats for the first time in decades if he were the Republican nominee for that seat. And so last night, Republicans in the state rallied around Roger Marshall. He is a sitting congressman, and he will now be the Republican nominee, and he will face Barbara Bollier, the Democrat in that race. And it is now considered by the prognosticators to continue to be a likely Republican seat.
Yeah, Democrats need to pick up, it depends on who wins the presidency, either 3 or 4 seats to get a majority in the Senate. But Kansas wasn't necessarily on the Democrats' flight path to get there, right?
It wasn't necessarily, but it would have been if last night Kris Kobach had become the GOP nominee. But now they have a much better chance of taking back seats in Colorado. There's 2 seats on the ballot in Georgia this year in a very unique election that they're looking at. Susan Collins' seat in Maine is also available. So there may be some other better opportunities for them now.
In our last minute or so, Francesca, what do you have your eye on now over the next week-ish?
I think what I have my eye on over the next week is the same as the next 90 days, which is this presidential election at this point. And although depending on how everything goes on election day, it could be slightly more than the next 90 days, depending on how long it takes to get the election results in some states and areas. So I hope we'll have another chance to talk about this before then, though.
I hope so, too. Francesca, thanks a lot for joining us today. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Francesca Chambers, White House correspondent for McClatchy. It's our weekly roundup of some of the top stories in national politics. Talk to her today about some of the big national political stories we've been following, including negotiations continuing today on the next federal stimulus package for economic recovery from the coronavirus pandemic. You can follow some of the latest news about politics here in Wisconsin and around the country over at WPR.org, or pick up some of those stories and comment on them over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And we'd love to hear from you if you feel personally affected in one way or another by the Democratic National Convention cutting back more and more on their plans for Milwaukee this month, bumped back to this month. If your business has been affected by that, you had high hopes for all the people being brought into the city. I'd like to hear your story. If you're planning to go to, attend, protest at, whatever, interact with the convention, let us know your story. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Yesterday on Central Time, we invited you to call in with the summer outdoor activities that you had going on during an unusual summer travel season. We heard some great stories. Thank you so much if you called in to share what you've been up to. We also got some great ideas from a listener on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ashley writes, an ongoing joke for some friends here around Stevens Point is that our summer lives haven't really changed at all this year. Life is full of biking, kayaking, hiking, camping, and swimming as usual, just at a safe distance now, which is great. Ashley goes on, last week I explored a new region to me in Marinette County, the waterfall capital of the state, compliments of David Hedquist's book, Waterfalling in Wisconsin, and boy, there were lots of them. Ashley also camped within the Chequamegon-Nicolet National Forest. It was full of beauty and endless activities. Cheers to the Wisconsin outdoors. Ashley, thanks so much for that. Also, thanks, Ashley, for including a picture of Zoe the dog at Kremlin Falls. Well, you can keep sharing. We want to know what you are up to this summer, how you're enjoying the outdoors in an unusual season. You can always tweet us at Central Time WPR or post your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. If you want to share a picture of a puppy, we'd all appreciate it. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.